We're at the intersection of race, identity, and the history of slavery that is interwoven in the racial disparities that we see today. It's an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Reverend Alex G. traveled to the Deep South to meet his white relatives and to confront the traumas of his enslaved ancestors. Tracing his family roots, this is the subject of his new documentary. It's called Justified Journey. Have you confronted racism in your own family or family history? Tell us what you did and what more you'd like to do. What questions do you have about being a good ally, being a good ally to communities of color? We're at 800-642-1234. Reverend Alex G. leads Fountain of Life Covenant Church. It's a multiracial, multigenerational congregation in Madison. He hosts the podcast called Black Like Me, which invites listeners to see the world through the perspective of one black man. Pastor Alex G., welcome back to the Ideas Network. Can you hear us? I think we're having some difficulty hearing Pastor Alex G. We're talking about his new film. It's called Justified Journey, which follows his quest to trace his family roots, and it's led to this discovery that he had a white cousin who is a descendant of a man who had raped his great-great-great-grandmother Venus, who was his slave. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Pastor G, can you hear me now? And I think we're still having some difficulties getting Pastor Alex G. And as we talk with him about his family pursuit to understand his roots and his genealogy, wondering if you have your own genealogy story to share. Have you gone to look at and trace your roots? And what did you discover about your family? And how have you come to terms with what you've discovered? We're going to be talking here in a moment with Pastor Alex G. of Fountain of Life Covenant Church. In 1992, he helped found the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development, works to engage the greater Madison community to empower African-American individuals, families, and communities to bring about hope, transformation, and justice. He's also the host of the podcast Black Like Me, and the new documentary he has that just came out, it's called Justified Journey, documenting tracing his family roots to rural Mississippi and the time of slavery. You can join in about your family story, about tracing your family roots, your own genealogy. Have you confronted racism in your own family or your family tree? Tell us what you did and what more you'd like to do. Are you a white parent? How do you talk to your children about racism? What do you think our country needs to do to reconcile its past and move forward? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We're going to be talking in a moment here with Pastor Alex G. about racism and how he has learned about his own family and how he has come to reconcile it. How is your community doing amid the Black Lives Matter protests? What changes are you seeing? Or are things staying mostly the same? Have you been a protester? And what brings you out? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Pastor G, are you still there? Are you there?
I am. Kate, I'm so sorry. I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me.
And goodness. Well,
so anyway, I appreciate your team taking me on my landline. So
I'm glad we're on the old trusty landline.
That's right.
Tell
glad
you what.
We kept that. Glad we kept that. But I am doing well, and it's so great to be back on the Ideas Network.
Tell us about Justified Journey and what your story is about.
Sure. Kate, I've always been intrigued with genealogy. I'm in my mid-50s. I was an eighth grader here in Madison when Alex Haley's miniseries Roots came out. As a freshman at West High School in 77, I wrote a paper about genealogy, and I went to the State Historical Society to research using microfiche. My daughter laughs. She's a librarian, and she has no idea what that means. So I've always been intrigued by that. We offer through our nonprofit initiative, Justified Anger, a U.S. Black History course to help white allies understand the social context of race relations. And so one day, just as a precursor to the lecture, I just said I'm gonna show how close my connection is with slavery. Did some research, met a cousin who responded to one of my messages, and found out that he was a descendant of Reuben Joshua G., the slave owner of the G plantation, and it is actually the place where my great-great-great-grandmother Venus was owned, enslaved, and raped by Reuben, and their child was Henderson G., my grandfather's grandfather. So the journey is really meeting those white relatives in order to contextualize U.S. black history and its impact in my own family. It was a journey to really explore that so that I could understand the United States and history more clearly.
Yeah, you met your cousin John Harkins along this journey. Tell us about John.
John responded to a mess. I Googled Reuben G's name. John responded. His post came up, and he basically said, "I'm a 70-year-old white man, and I just found out that my great-great-grandfather, Reuben G., had a black son. Does anyone know anything about Henderson G.?" I responded about 11 o'clock that night. By 10 the next morning, John had responded. We went back and forth, and eventually he invited me down to New Orleans, where he lived, in order to meet and talk about this history. So this was brand new to him. It wasn't new to me because I'm a student of history, and my story is basically the story of most African Americans in this country. But I had a great meeting with John in 2017, and we were drawing on paper to try to figure out our relationship and the genealogy, and I think we found out that we were fourth cousins. But what's very interesting is while we were talking about the role our white family members had in the lives of our black family members, it was the same day that horrible event in Charlottesville was going on. Oh. So while we were talking about my history, my family, my great-great-grandmother being stolen and raped, there were men marching in Charlottesville talking about blood and soil and how America had been taken from them.
What was that like, sitting down with John Harkins and finding this intersection, so many threads, but being from totally different walks of life and visions of what life is?
It was surreal, Kate. It's one thing to hear about it. I think even going back to roots, it really followed the story of Kunta Kinte, but it did not really show the intersection of children born to slaves as a result of rape by the slave owners. I think 12 Years Slave talked more about that brutality. Mm. But I think I was just trying to put this together, like what that horror must have been like, what their lives must have been like. And I think meeting white relatives who are also G's solidified in my mind that this was not fiction. This was real. And just trying to grasp the fact that we had the same blood coursing in our veins. And I think one of the most if there's anything that could have made that moment any more surreal than I'm sitting in this home with white relatives and the event in Charlottesville is going on. John mentioned that his great-grandfather, Robert Lafayette G., had married Beulah Wilder. And I said, wait a minute. My great-grandfather, Oscar G., married a woman named Lilla Wilder. John and I found out that we were double cousins, that we were both G's and Wilders. And I don't know. Like, and at some point, Kate, my mind stops because I don't know if there was breeding. I don't know what happened that the G's and the Wilders from one plantation would be related to the G's and the Wilders of black families. It was overwhelming. So interesting, but overwhelming. But John and I are actually double cousins.
Reverend Alex G. with us, talking about his journey and the documentary Justified Journey, Deep Roots and Going Back to the Deep South, looking at the history of slavery. You can join in. We will be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're spending the hour with Reverend Alex G. of Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison, exploring the framework of racism in America, the difficult through lines that we talked about in privilege, in race, slave history there. Reverend G thinks about all of this. His podcast is called Black Like Me. He's also the focus of a new documentary called Justified Journey. What do you think of the way that racism is talked about in our communities? What is missing from the conversation? Have you confronted racism in your own family, in your family roots? Share your story, your journey, 800-642-1234. And Reverend G stays with us. As we were headed there to the news break, you were talking about how there's a strong tendency in our world to try to measure, whether families of color are finding an improvement in their circumstances and in their environment, and that you're exhausted by this particular question and it's missing the point.
It is, because it's a point that's not created by people of color, and then we're not funded at a level. There are not enough of us to really fix the issue. So I'm now beginning to ask people, well, how has your organization become more diverse, more anti-racist, more anti-black since the Race to Equity report came out of Justified Anger? And people look at me, or they'll get quiet, thinking, well, no, I'm asking you how you think things are. Like, this has nothing to do with my organization. Well, if things were better, it would show up in each of our organizations and our board structure and our volunteer structure. And so it just shows me that people don't, that the majority of culture don't think that they really have a role in addressing these issues, that it's a black problem, so we're going to fix it. That is exhausting, but it's also false. We don't have the ability to fix it.
Oh, like that was history, but I don't think that way, and therefore I'm off the hook.
Right, and our organization is off the hook. We would hire people of color if they applied, but they don't think about the systemic processes and where they advertise and where they find pools of applicants. They don't look at any of that. The assumption is if someone walked through and they were the most qualified, you know, all these qualifiers, we would not hesitate to hire them. And so we have unemployment and disparity because we just chose not to do it. You know, we've had covenant clauses. Covenant agreements on our books, even in Madison, Nakoma, Shorewood, where it was stated, I found the records where black people could not live there. That has a huge economic, you know, impact. And so we can't just assume that black people can fix that by moving into communities from which they've been excluded for 60 or 70 years. So everyone's got to work at this, Kate.
Let's bring in another call. John is joining us from northern Wisconsin. Hi, John.
How you doing? Just want to start off by saying I agree with a ton of what you're saying. And like one thing I noticed is I grew up in Milwaukee for 33 years and I moved to northern Wisconsin. And I guess one thing that I noticed is a lot of the policies that you're talking about that hold people of color down in cities and whatnot also affect like poor people in this area, regardless of color, And it, like how you were saying, you know, you can have people on the same block, but one person has 150 years of equity. You see a lot of that same thing, you know, up here. You got one family living $20,000 a year, and then, you know, another family down the road that, you know, has a $500,000 house. And I guess as we talk about all this stuff, you know, I hope that we create policies that look at the entire problem. And I think in the past we created policies that target groups and they're not, they don't have a broad enough umbrella to get everyone up, if that makes sense.
John, I think you're referring to this pervasiveness of poverty that is holding people back. Reverend?
Well, that's systemic also. You know, systems don't only work for race, they work for sexism. And so that's there's a system around that. He's absolutely right. However, I don't want to be in a position where I'm refereeing the pain Olympics. Who's worse off, the poor, the black? But I will say this, a white person can put a suit on and walk in a bank and no one sees your net worth. We have Henry Louis Gates. We have black people. We have Oprah, who couldn't see a bag in Switzerland. We have my experience. You can dress up, have a doctorate degree, own a home. My family has 12 degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but yet my daughter endures things on campus by students saying to her face, it's not fair that you get a scholarship. Or say in her presence, it's not fair that black students get academic, athletic scholarships to this campus and take away seats from deserving white people. So I think that that's a systemic oppression also that's got to be addressed. But let's not lump all of that together when black people are talking about the preponderance of being underrepresented in places. We are under siege in this country, and we have built this country for 400 years. We were here before many of the populations that he's referring to in northern Wisconsin. We were here before America became a nation, and we were speaking English before many European immigrants came to this country. So I'm not saying that those things are not important, but I will not be apologetic either by saying it is time that African Americans are treated fairly given what we have contributed to this country and what we have endured by being a part of this country.
Before we take another call, I want to trace more of your family history and your discoveries. Where did you go as you found yourself in Mississippi?
I went to Leake County, which is where Reuben G. moved after he received the Homestead Act. I found that document online, and it was signed by President Van Buren. So as a Welsh settler in the United States, he was basically given carte blanche to buy land, to develop wealth in order to own slaves, in order to rape black women and have children, because at that point it was illegal to slave trade. And so white men began siring black children, biracial children who were slaves. And so I went to the epicenter of all of that, and I went to the G grocery store, which had a sign over it said founded by Thomas W. G. And my grandfather used to speak of having an older white uncle, but I assumed he meant a fair-skinned, light-skinned black person. So to walk there, see my name on a street sign, to see my last name on, you know, basically like, you know, the corner, you know, the community quick trip, so to speak, but to see the name of the proprietor, and it's the name that my grandfather mentioned that he knew as a kid, blew my mind.
Oh my goodness. What did you do there? Who did you talk to?
I talked to Mary Ann G, the owner. So here's what's really wild. Mary Ann and I are descendants of brothers. She is descended. So our great-great-grandfathers, Henderson and Robert Lafayette, were brothers. Mm-hmm. They both were sons of the slave owner. So I mean, I have black cousins who are not as closely related to me as she is. And when she saw my picture of Henderson, she followed me to my car and she said, "Can I get a picture? Can I get a copy of that picture? I've seen him before. I've seen that picture before." So my grandfather said that the black and the white G's used to play together until other white relatives came by, and then the black kids, my relatives, would have to go through the back door again. But I could not wrap my brain around the fact that these are blood relatives, that because people have always thought my last name is odd and it's different, but to see the relevance of my name of G in funeral homes, on streets, on laundromats, on gas stations, on grocery stores, was both empowering but also a bit demeaning, because I realized how that wealth was generated.
Let's bring in Joe now in Ballard Lake. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hello. How? Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to talk about what I have discovered through my own reasons and a journey I went on, which is interesting. It's kind of what I think is a hidden part of our history, a very important part. And that is, we understand it much more now because of new research in brain and mind development. There have been generations and generations of women of color, particularly African-American women in the United States, who have raised children from birth, you know, through their childhood. And we know now that that influence has really built the physical infrastructure of their brains, their neural pathways and their clusters. We know so much now because of the relationship that caregivers and parents have on their children.
And I understand that, Joe, you tried to find the woman who looked after you as a child?
I did. And it's kind of relevant to the pandemic. I was 1 year old when my father died very suddenly from polio. This was in Pittsburgh, so this is sort of a more northern story. And my mother was pregnant, and 4 months later, when she delivered my brother, he only lived for a few days. So my mother went into quite a big depression, which she came out of. And this was never hidden in the family. We knew this all occurred. But there was this woman named Helen who lived with us, basically had been hired to as a live-in maid and also to take care of my brother and I.
Helen, African-American?
She was African-American, okay. And I just adored her. And she left when I was 5. And many years later, I did a lot of work in juvenile justice, and I had talked to my mother about it. My mother also said that Helen basically held the family together through this incredibly dark time. My mother passed away, and to keep this short, I was working in juvenile justice, and a brain research fellow gave a talk about something called sad brain syndrome. And what he was saying was his research showed that if between birth and 3, in that age, you know, that time, a mother went into prolonged depression, melancholy is the word he used, the child's physical brain would develop in a way that mirrored the emotional state of the mother. He did not see this in the fathers, but he saw it in mothers very dramatically. So therefore, that person would have chronic problems with depression.
And we're really short on time, but I want to know, did you find Helen?
I found her family. I felt absolutely required to go and thank them because I felt like I didn't have that condition. It must have been because of Helen's intervention. And after it was 12 years and I found the family, it was remarkable. And they even had photographs of me. We're so linked, our you know, as Americans in ways we don't even imagine. And we have to imagine. This is what we have to understand. And this insanity of separation and taking advantage of one or the other. And, you know, so I learned a lot. And I know I don't want to keep going on about this. But
well, thank you so much for bringing that as we talk with Reverend Alex G. about his life story and yours, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Let's get back to our conversation with Reverend Alex G. of Madison as we spend the hour discussing racial disparities in America and the roots of racism. His new documentary is called Justified Journey, which documents him tracing his family roots to rural Mississippi and the traumas of his enslaved ancestors. Reverend G., I want to give you an opportunity to respond to Joe in Ballard Lake about finding Helen.
Sure. I mean, no disrespect to Joe's experience, but I must speak honestly because I'm also a descendant of day workers. When he talked about finding Helen, like under your breath, you said, oh, Helen was an indentured servant. Who raised Helen's children? And what did Helen's husband think when she lived in their house? And those women who worked as help were called the N-word. Men made passes at them. Women treated them like second-class citizens in the community and the neighborhood. Many of those women were school teachers, and when integration happened, they lost their jobs because 36,000 black school teachers lost their jobs. Many became domestics and had master's degrees in chemistry, and they changed white people's children's diapers. And so when I hear that story, I think about what Helen lost. Helen's take on that is much different than Joe's. It wasn't my baby's been found. She was a second or third class citizen. It's the best she could do. She ran a household and made a pittance of what she was worth and then had to raise her own children with what was left over. And it's still the story of black people making the world better for white people who do not stand up for fair pay and for their rights and for the sharing of a will. And so I hear those stories, but it's not just enough to know that we can look at each other, not hate each other. We're talking about centuries of disparity, of rape, of robbery, with no discussion, no room for discussion, no fathoming of discussion of what financial redistribution. What did it cost Helen to be their help? And how has that impacted her family and her children and her grandchildren? And so I get his story, but how has that helped Helen's children? Mm-hmm. And how does just understanding that we can be in the same place without an understanding of why we are in different places, the impact of that on black people? We are still second or third class citizens. Those stories don't help us to feel better about ourselves and our place in America.
You mentioned the N-word, and you, in a recent episode of your podcast, talked about a virtual training you were giving when the meeting was Zoom bombed by people who hacked into the meeting and yelled the N-word. And you noted in your podcast that black people face worse forms of racism than that. Can you expand on that?
Sure, that's a great question. They actually wrote the word about 85 times, and they wrote KKK 250 times, and then they said all N-words need to die. So the FBI actually got involved in this situation. But what I would say is that's noisy racism, and those cowards probably would never say that to my face. But the silent racism, the silent N-word is, where has our community stopped and said, here's how much money we're putting towards anti-racism training. And here's the investment we're going to make, 5%, 8%, whatever. Here's the percentage we're going to make in empowering black-led organizations who have worked and survived under what we now know are dire conditions. We're going to strengthen them and their infrastructure so that they can continue to make the communities better for all. We've reduced all of this to reading an anti-racism and that we read before board meetings and gatherings and online conferences, and then we go about our work of not changing any of this systemically. And in my podcast, I said, I'd rather be called the N-word weekly than to have my white, well-meaning friends be silent and not contemplate their role or the community's role or the role of the chancellor, universe, city, county, state, to put resources to change this attitude. We always relegate that to three or four Trump supporters, but we don't talk about the silence of more of the progressive people who don't think that this is a systemic problem. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you, Alex. Just turn the other cheek. But it is the fact that they don't understand that the fact that those people who did that can grow up to become judges, attorneys, teachers, pastors, pilots, and it's not in a vacuum. It's pervasive. Mm-hmm. And until we understand that, call me the N-word rather than being silent on the larger issue.
Well, as you talk about nonprofit boards, let's bring in Yvonne in Lake Geneva. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi. Thanks for giving me the time, and thank you so much, Reverend, for I've learned so much from you, and your explanation is so clear, the best I've heard.
Thank you.
The problem with the statues. I am from a very not diverse background, and mm-hmm. I will be honest with you that I don't interact with a lot of people of diversity on a regular basis, but our nonprofit serves a community for wildlife, and that's something that brings all of us together, compassion for, you know, the unfortunate. And I would love to include more people in our organization that are diverse, but I don't even know how to do that when I don't have relationships with those people that are natural. And I wondered if there is something that you can tell me and maybe other people like me who could reach out and actually start something proactively to bring people who are interested in our mission into that.
Great question. I hear that a lot. I address that a lot on Black Like Me. I hope you catch some of those episodes because conversations address this. It comes down to something you said, relationships. And so many people will say, I live in this part of the country, I live in this neighborhood, and it's not very diverse. But I think in order to address issues of racism, we have to ask the question, why is this community not diverse? There are rules. There were reasons, economic and otherwise legal, that made it so that either that was not attractive to people of color. I think there are places that are beautiful and affordable in this community, but there's a cost to living in rural white Wisconsin if I'm a black man with a black wife and a black family. And so I think people need to understand the cost of that emotionally to do that. But it comes down to relationships. And relationships aren't just built by the proximity of our homes. White people who want to build a relationship with black people have to find where black people are. There are more black people in Wisconsin today than there has ever been in the existence of humanity. And so that means even within your profession, is there an affiliation, an association of African-American wildlife, whatever, or you know, like what are the organizations? And go and be a part of them. Find black organizations, black faith communities, but white people have to go to where people of color are, because we're often asked, oh, come over here, cross the street, cross the tracks, cross the highway, come over here, come to our backyard, come to our barbecue, but they rarely come to us. And so I feel that people hide behind, I don't know anyone, if it's a value. And you have to then ask, why is it a value to have diverse people on it, to say you've got it? Because you have to also ask, what has been prohibitive in your industry that has not been welcoming to black people? So I think as we get to the root cause, we can begin to address the issues, but it comes down to relationships. You have to put yourself out of your way, find those folks, and build meaningful relationships, because the reason why most of your organization is white is probably because most of your organization is white, and that's the networks they reach into. So it comes down to relationships, and there are people of color who really do want to build meaningful relationships, but not for the sake of a quota or a diversity position on a board. How do you help black causes? And in return, you might meet people who like what you're doing. I know black people who like nature, camping, wildlife, but they don't have relationships with the people who lead those organizations. So it really comes down to meaningful relationships that are about the relationship and not just about diversification.
We only have a few seconds left, but I just want to ask you about Congressman John Lewis and the passing of the civil rights leader. Is there anything you want to say about his legacy?
He's a giant. I had a chance to meet him in an airport in Atlanta. He was gracious enough to talk with me and meet with me. And I asked him, Congressman, if there's one thing you could say to young people or to say to our community, what would it be? He would say, know your history, know the strength and the accomplishments of black people, and don't stop pursuing excellence in your rightful place in this country. That's what he said to me.
Reverend G, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I enjoyed being here, Kate. Thank you so much for your invitation.
That's the Reverend Alex G., lead pastor of Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison. You can find a link to his podcast, Black Like Me, on our program page. It's WPR.org/mornings. There's also a link, by the way, to the new documentary, Justified Journey, that focuses on G's quest to trace his family roots. Just ahead, it is On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.